You're listening to SBS.
Hi, it's Noor Haider, one of the hosts of The Guardian's daily news podcast, Full Story. Every weekday, we bring you a single story, going beyond the headlines and taking you closer to The Guardian's journalism. Combining personal storytelling with analysis, we take you inside the stories that matter most. For fearless, independent reporting that holds power to account, listen to Full Story from The Guardian, wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to SBS News.
Eddie Izzard is a multi-talented artist whose career spans film, theatre and activism. Now she brings her unique brand of charisma and creativity to the Sydney Opera House with one of the world's most enduring tragedies. This is Shakespeare's Hamlet, as you've never seen it before. Izzard performs on the blank canvas of a bare stage, letting Shakespeare's words and pure storytelling take the spotlight. Izzard shifts between the play's 23 characters with clarity and emotional depth. He's been talking to SBS's Will Brincat.
Well, Susie, you're here for Izzard, the tragedy of Hamlet, in which you shift between over 20 characters. What prompted you to take on such a massive task?
I've been wanting to do Hamlet for some time. I've been pushing to try and set up a project where a production where I could do this, having already done Christopher Marlowe's Edward II, having done Elizabethan verse, being very intimidated by the Elizabethan verse poetry itself when I was a kid, because I'm dyslexic. I'm severely atypically dyslexic. I have half of the traits in a very strong way. So wanting to act at the age of 7, having seen a play, The Boy with a Cart by Christopher Fry, and I thought, this I have to do. And I think it was a substitution of my mother's affection. She had died a couple of years before, and suddenly the audience could give me this. So I wanted to push for that. And I couldn't audition well. I couldn't sight read very well. I was smaller, so all the bigger boys were getting roles at that time. And then it came up, maybe in kids in Australia get this as well, where because of the link to, back to Shakespeare, they say, right, we're going to read Shakespeare in English literature. If they do English literature, if they do that, they might bring up a play. We're going to read it in class. Not a great way to do Shakespeare, reading it in class. But I was excited. I thought, well, this is having a play. I'm allowed to read a play here. And I can remember that sense in my head. But I found it very intimidating, looking at it, thinking, I can't quite work out what he's saying. So I thought maybe Shakespeare isn't for me. And as I have a comedic career, and then in 1993 I got a separate dramatic agent, and I've pushed for drama all the way up to being Tony nominated in the early 2000s on Broadway, and pushing my dramas and my comedies separately, which is a bit odd. No, people don't normally do that. I've been pushing to want to get into Shakespeare. Richard III was on the list, and then I thought, no, I want to go for Hamlet. And because Great Expectations I did as a solo performance, and a lot of people are doing solo performances. Mm-hmm. Sarah Snook, to great success, Australian actress who's done very well there, and Andrew Scott and other people, Jodie Comer doing hers. So I'm just one of that group, and it just happens to have chosen Hamlet. And now we're over 250 performances, and here at the Sydney Opera House.
Multiple extensions around the world.
Yes, which is very pleasing. And I just, it's great, through America several times and through Britain and now Australia and New Zealand. Mm. And now we just put on extra shows, just put on today as well.
Fantastic. You mentioned there the word intimidating.
Yes.
I did see an interview where you said that you wanted to make Shakespeare more accessible. Do you think you've done that, and how so?
Yeah, I don't know if I want to make it more accessible, but my brother who did the adaptation, and myself, and Selena Kadar, my director, we wanted to make it as accessible as it was in 1600, 1601, when it first came out. Now, I am sure, now I can't prove this because you can't go back and talk to people who died 400 years ago, but I feel sure that Shakespeare, that Kit Marlowe, that Kidd, all these players, Johnson, they all wrote their plays because they wanted the audience to react viscerally. I use this word viscerally because I think it's the best word for it. They did not want an audience to go, oh, what's he talking about? Oh, what's that mean? Can we look that up? I don't understand that. And that's what a lot of people 400 years later might feel. But there's a certain words, vocabulary, extra scenes that he put in, because there are three different versions of Hamlet. Mm-hmm. So people say, well, the version is 5 hours long. I don't believe people were standing. I don't mean the groundlings were standing for 5 hours. No toilets there. Food, drink, refreshments, intervals. No one knows what went on. So I think probably the version was 2 hours. Having experimented a lot with different lengths of plays, my brother did an adaptation. 2 hours, 2 hours 20, including the interval, is how long it is. But the actual text, we wanted the play to work. This is what I said to Selena. Let's make the play work, the story work, because it comes from, it's not really about his son dying. It's really about Amleth, which was written by Saxo Grammaticus, who was the Danish historian, who wrote about this legendary figure, not a mythological figure. So he wasn't a fiction. He was believed to be alive, and his uncle did kill his father, and he did go to England, but there he won a battle and married, which isn't in the play. So elements of that story is in Hamlet, the tragedy of Hamlet, and so we wanted to bring that there so that people would walk away going, I was moved by that story, I was driven by that story, and that's what I think I am able to bring to the stage. And because it's a solo performance, they could really concentrate on Shakespeare's words and the stories and the plot lines and where the characters are going. So that's what people have said to me many times, and I'm very pleased by that.
And speaking of characters, what's the challenge of sort of moving seamlessly through so many characters while you're on stage on your own?
Well, it's something I developed from before, and it's like playing chess against yourself. You may have heard of people who are very good at chess, and they play chess, and then they can turn around and feel they're a different person now, a different character who's going to try and win against this person. Then you turn around and try and win against this person. It's being able to switch off and switch over to the other person. And so my characters, the separation characters, they're not caricatures. I didn't want them to be that. I want them to be subtle changes. But there is physicality and a certain vocal change that happens between characters. And through context, I use the intelligence of the audience. They can work out where I am going. And as other solo performers are showing, this is something that is happening around the world. And so I've just... We've spent a lot of time doing that and working with Commedia dell'arte and Didi Hopkins, my movement director, to make the changes very sharp so it's crisp in between them. And using the architecture of the stage as I move around, if I'm talking to a character here and I move over here, then I have to come back and finish talking to them there if they're going to respond to me. Otherwise people say, well, which character are you doing now? So I'm very particular on that to make it work so it's easy for the audience.
Has to be very, very clear. So with this, we get the dramatic thespian Eddie Izzard, but you recently did some comedy shows. Such a contrast between
those. My other day job.
Yes, your other day job. Such a contrast. I mean, what do you love about getting to wear those two different hats and that audiences know you for both?
Well, the thing about Shakespeare is that you cannot improvise on the lines. The story, the characters, they will stay locked. Emotionally, you can change it from night to night, and that's what I do to keep it alive. Because you'll know, like it happens in religion a lot, in prayers, people just go through a lip service on it. You can get into performing a production where you will do each night do the scene in the same way. But if you adjust it each night, if you try playing the lines in a different emotional way each night, it keeps it alive, and so you never quite know what you're going to do, and you're not going to annoy another actor because you are the other actor. So this is the way I keep it alive. The comedy is somewhere I can ad-lib, I can take it in different directions, and it has a surreality that isn't in Shakespeare. But I keep them apart, and people can work it out, and the Shakespeare, we're not doing a comedy version of Hamlet, this is the tragedy of Hamlet, and it is one that I hope that if Shakespeare came and watched, if he suddenly could float back into time, he'd go, okay, I wasn't planning it like this, but yes, it's
good. But it works.
It works.
I approve.
because I'm sure he was a kid who did not go to university. All the other writers went to university, and he had to break through that wall. Imagine that glass ceiling, glass wall that he had to get through. And I'm sure that he wanted people to react and go, and how does that feel? Because I'm getting these standing ovations, I just I think he would be happy with that.
Oh, marvellous. You're multilingual. You speak French, German, a bit of Spanish, I believe you said earlier.
Yeah, mi español no es fantástico, pero mi autoconfianza es bueno. Because if you've got French and English, then you're... Vale.
So
I can jump in, I can say, hey, Madrid, buenas noches. Well, I use an F word in between.
Mais vous parlez très bien français, ça je sais.
I say my French is good, my German's okay,
It's more than good,
My Deutsch is gut. My accent is quite good, which I'm pleased with. But my brother's the expert. My brother who did the adaptation for Hamlet and Great Expectations, he is the natural academic of the family.
Oh.
And he's about grammar first, communication second in the languages. And I'm kind of communicate first and then I try and get the grammar right.
I'm the same. I'm the same. You know, if you can be understood by people, that's the main thing. And then you tidy up the grammar.
Way, but yeah. Mark is very... strict to the ground. We were just talking to him last night, and so we've got another Spanish lesson on Tuesday. So we're doing Spanish, because I will get my Spanish up, and then you can stand on stage and go, hey, okay, los animales salvajes están en forma, están todos en forma. And so if I'm getting things wrong, and I did this in German, because after Brexit, I thought, this is not a positive thing for my country. So I started developing my shows in French and German, and ad-libbing and in French and German, and I thought, I can't get all the German endings right, because they have a masculine feminine neuter and a nominative, accusative, dative, and genitive.
So
that's seven different ways you could play around with things. And I just thought, I'll estimate it.
Okay.
And let the German audiences, I'll assume their cleverness, which is a German word, clever, which is the German word for clever is clever, which is nice. And because we have 15,000. No, because of the Anglo-Saxons, loads of English words are actually German. And so I left it to them, and it was fine. It was like a kid, like I'm a big grown-up, but speaking like an 8-year-old or something.
You couldn't do that with the French, though. You couldn't
I do it with the French.
It's like the French, on est dur avec ceux qui ne parlent pas.
Oh, no, well, actually, the Germans were like that as well. I decided it doesn't matter. I think the people in charge of... We actually had in Berlin, we did sit down to say, what can you say, what shouldn't you say? But I just found if I estimate it, people can work it out, even if they might want to write to their MP, the person in charge.
That's a bit extreme.
Was ist los hier? Diese Engländer.
I'm sure they
made a mistake, but I don't...
appreciated the effort.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's people with... who are real sticklers for things. And then there's a lot of very groovy German people, very groovy French people. Those are the people I hang out with.
Okay, well, let's just say groovy multilingual audiences. So performing in those different languages, how different is it performing for all those different audiences as opposed to a native English speaking audiences?
Not different at all.
Okay,
I mean, I look for this because it's the comedy. If you think about it, if you think that the Germans have no sense of humor, the French have a visual sense of humor, the Chinese have a whatever sense of humor, then you're wrong. You're just wrong, because I have been there and tried it, and in three different extra languages now. Basically, there are multiple different senses of humor in every country. If you think about it, there are mainstream comedians. If we take Australia, the mainstream comedians will talk about sports stars, politicians, things in the shops, things on television. And let's go to another country that probably wouldn't work in another country so well because other countries may not know of those sports stars and things on telly and whatever. But if you talk about love, sex, death, playing the banjo, haircuts. You can go all around the world and people say, yes, we know about love, sex, death, haircuts, families,
playing the banjo,
having a bad leg. You know, there's a load of human things, wild animals. 95% of things you can talk about. So all you have to do is find people with the same sense of humor as you. And Monty Python's already proved, as it is known around the world, to a cult audience, but not necessarily to a mainstream audience, that they proved that I could go out there and find these people. And I've played 46 countries now, so I can just keep on going and keep adding people in. And all you need to do is change the words. So if I write about human sacrifice, which is an insane thing, but the Vikings did it and the Aztecs did it, miles apart, weren't even phoning each other, checking out, is it working for you? Is it helping your crops? Not really. Okay, none of that. So I worked out that that we idiot humans have done horrible things like this, and then we've moved beyond that. But if you change those words and do it in German or French or Spanish or Chinese or Mandarin or whatever it was, everyone would go, yeah, why did we used to do that? That seems insane. That must have been political control. So that's the mandate that I gave myself. Go out and find the audiences. I just have to do it. And I'm very determined, so I will go out and find the audience. We're taking Shakespeare to India, taking Hamlet to India. And we're going to be going through there and doing Hamlet in French as well. Maybe the soliloquies in French.
Wow.
Être ou ne pas être, c'est là la question. Sein oder nicht sein, das ist hier die Frage, do it in German. And maybe just do the soliloquies that way and the rest of it in English. But I'm up for experimenting. And I think a lot of people out there in this world where crazy extremist politics of the right wing is happening and trying to tear everyone apart, and I'm saying, no, find the connections, make connections, not break connections.
Well, this, I have to say, that's the perfect segue to my next question, because you've run for political office in the UK a few times in the last few years.
Twice, yeah.
Yeah, a couple of times. There's a lot going on in the UK at the moment, let's just say. And you said you'll keep running.
Oh,
why?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because I think four things you need. You'd have a world view, which I do, and that is everyone in the world has the right to a fair chance in life. That's what I'm fighting for, and I think most people in the world would fight for that. Communication, ability to communicate, to articulate, which I think I can do. And you need to be able to analyze systems and say, keep that, we've got to change that, but that is working, so don't destroy that. That analysis part is something that I have developed in trying to get, you know, I came out as trans 40 years ago, so I analyzed it. It'd be better to be honest and truthful in this world of political lies. Why not come out and say what's honest about yourself and take the brickbats and the outrageous fortune situations that Hamlet was dealing with. Just get out there and be honest about it. So I've done this. I've done two selections. I came second in both. There's a transphobic thing that's floating around at the moment, and, well, trans people do exist. Women's rights are human rights, and trans rights are human rights. End of story. We have to make it work in the world, and let's just keep marching forward. So I'm going to keep doing creative things and keep pushing to get in, because I'm not going to leave it to the right wing. And the impunity of lying with no regard for any consequences. If people can, because if you think about politics, it's like your CV. Someone will get up and say, please vote for me for this, that, the other, and they might embellish their thing and put a good shine on it. And we expect that with CVs, with politics, but just complete out and out lying. Just this thing of impunity with no political consequences, it seems. If that exists, then humanity is
no
not going to make it to the next century.
Those ideas.
I'm a radical and a moderate. You know, I do radical things with a moderate message. So that's what I'm going to do. I think I've proved in my life, running 130 marathons, raising money for charity over £4.5 million, about $9 million Australian dollars now, and doing things, coming out as trans 40 years ago. I've tried to live the life that I've talked about, and doing Hamlet all around the world is another positive part of that. People might say, oh, you're lane changing, you're not allowed to lane change, but why not? We were all creative, very creative, when we were at kindergarten. Do you know about the story? They gave paper clips to kindergarten kids, and kindergarten kids came up with genius levels of invention of what you could do with a paper clip, because they hadn't been told what was wrong and right. And later on, we get locked into certain things. You're no good at that, don't do any more of that, and you're no good at that, and you're no good at tennis, and you're no good at creating things.
I did not know that.
I've tried to keep locked into the centre of my creativity.
You've been publicly challenging people's assumptions about gender and identity for decades. Do you find yourself surprised by how much this conversation has changed, or by how much it hasn't, perhaps?
No, not surprised, really, because when I came out, there was no conversation. And now there's a lot of conversation, maybe too heated. But gender wars that they talk about, the wars, the cultural wars, these aren't wars. There's no body count here. It's discussions, debates, maybe heated debates.
Heated debates.
But the right wing comes up with a phrase and they could think they can put that in and say, this is all hellish. No, it isn't. Remember the discussions, the heated discussions before marriage equality. I was here in Australia when you voted through and said, yes, marriage equality. It's about love. And now, have you noticed that all the shouting from the negative right wing side is just quietened down, because they realize, oh, God, it's for love. And that's probably a good thing in this world to have. And so that's what we're doing. I'm trying to be honest, being trans, and I'm coming out and just living my life. And so a lot of people go, well, this is positive. And there's so many people who are positive. But some people who are negative are very, can be extra loud. Maybe they have more money. They can put money into getting other people to shout out for them or whatever. And, you know, we're not going anywhere. We just exist, and we've been standing up, and I'm standing on the shoulders of giants, people who come before and have stood up and have had a very tough time of it. But, Yeah, we will keep forging forwards and standing up for ourselves.
Well, it's Pride Month, as you know. There's often a tendency to tell neat stories about progress. From your perspective, what's a more sort of honest story about where we are right now?
An honest story of where we are? Well, this is the thing. I'm going to take this for private and take it for human rights. Go back to the ancient Egyptians, okay? So we're going back, is it 7,000 years? Maybe 10,000 years if you want. And think of human rights back then. Human rights must have been so low. If you had a graph of good human rights and bad human rights, it must have been so low. Then you go up through all the early times of the Roman Empire and the slavery that was happening there and carry on, and then slavery comes back later on in the 1600s and people going to Africa and kidnapping people and turning them into slaves and all that hellishness. And even though it's quite rough and rocky at the moment, we do get better. We do get into a better place. And LGBTQ plus people, rainbow people with got a flag now. I don't remember having a flag when I was younger. But it's in a lot better place. And some people feel actually it's in a negative situation. But hang in there. Keep pushing through. It's getsbetter.com is a very good website to go to hear people's positive stories of going through things. And, you know, life will be tough. And you have to look at life as an adventure. Because in an adventure there will be positives and negatives, otherwise it doesn't make sense as a story. And you have to look at your life in that way, and all lives. Mum died when I was 6. She had cancer. She never smoked. I don't think she drank much. And and so why does she get cancer? She's a very loving person, a great addition to the world of humanity. Why was she taken? So I don't believe in a floaty guy upstairs. I think stuff like this happens. And we have to do the best we can and get on with it.
So you do world tours, you run for office, you run marathons. Is there a challenge? Is there a challenge you're yet to take on?
Not really. And it might look like I'm trying to do challenges. I'm not really. There's certain things. Remember when you were a teenager, you might have had a few things on your list of what you might like to do with your life. Well, I've kept that list.
Still have a few things.
I've kept that list, and I'm just doing the list. So that's all it is. So now if I come up with something, I learned to fly because I was scared of flying. So I've got a pilot's license because I pushed back on that. And now I'm not scared of flying. I push back the edges of fear and just try and do as much as I can in a positive way and see where we can get to.
Hi, it's Noor Haider, one of the hosts of The Guardian's daily news podcast, Full Story. Every weekday, we bring you a single story, going beyond the headlines and taking you closer to The Guardian's journalism. Combining personal storytelling with analysis, we take you inside the stories that matter most. For fearless, independent reporting that holds power to account, listen to Full Story from The Guardian, wherever you get your podcasts.